This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Gentlemen, please welcome in conversation with Julia Wheeler, it's Leveson Wood.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival and particularly to this event. Thank you for squashing up. Travel is all about making new friends, so I'm hoping that you're making new friends on those benches out there. Leveson Wood, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We've seen you walk in the Nile, we've seen you walk in the Himalayas, we've seen you walk in the Americas, but this new book, Eastern Horizons, I kind of like to think of as the prequel, really.
It is, actually. You know, this tells the story of when I hitchhiked from Nottingham to India at the age of 22, a couple of years ago now.
But how many years ago?
A few, I can't remember. But yeah, no, 2004 that was. And it was probably the journey that led me on to doing all the rest, actually. So it was great to have the opportunity to revisit it. The manuscript was on my laptop sitting there doing nothing for almost 15 years. And, this year my publishers said, you know, why don't we just publish that? So it was great.
And that story begins, strangely, at Alton Towers.
Tell us how
that started things off.
Well, I grew up in Stoke-on-Trent, and when I was about sort of 15, 16, we were very naughty, and rather than buying tickets, we used to sneak in under the fence. Nobody here from Alton Towers, is there? Sorry. But basically, on one of these little mini expeditions to Alton Towers, I managed to lose my wallet. And basically...
That's karma, isn't it?
It is karma, yeah. Exactly. So I lost my wallet, and I was very upset because it had my sort of, you know, my £3.50 in there and my young person's bus pass and all the rest of it. So I was very upset. But basically... I was very surprised when it got returned in the post because my ID was in there. And, it was returned with a little note from the guy who'd obviously found it that day, who happened to be an army officer. And I was, at that age, I was sort of thinking about a career in the army. And so I replied thanking him for returning the wallet. But I also asked him if he'd got any hints or tips on how to get in the army as a bit of advice for a young lad. And he replied with sort of 6 pages worth of sound advice, how to get into the army. All the sort of practical stuff on how you know, how many press-ups you need to do and all that sort of stuff. But also, he said, make sure you go away. The sentence that really resonated with me was, above all, travel. And so that was it. That sort of inspired me to go off on a gap year at the age of 18, like a lot of other youngsters. And I sort of didn't stop traveling ever since then.
And so how did you choose this route? First of all, tell us what the route is and tell us about your thinking of why you wanted to go on that journey.
So, well, I studied history at university at Nottingham, and I was particularly interested in overland journeys. That's what my dissertation was actually in, the Grand Tour, and I studied the pilgrim routes to the Middle East and, of course, the Silk Road. And I was really interested in Marco Polo's journeys to China, and also the Great Game in Central Asia between, you know, the sort of old... forays between the British and the Russians over the high passes of Central Asia. So I thought I better really put my money where my mouth is when I graduated and go on my own overland journey. And so I stuck my thumb up at Grantham Services and 5 months later ended up in India. So that was, all the way through Europe. I went on a slight detour through Russia over the Caucasus Mountains into Turkey and then Iran. Afghanistan, Pakistan, and finally India. So it was an incredible journey, especially at the age of 22, quite young and naive and probably slightly reckless. But like I say, it was an incredibly inspiring journey for me personally because I was looked after in the least likely places.
You make it sound really easy, but actually you got into quite a few scrapes.
There were a few scrapes, not least of which was trying to do the whole journey on £750, which included the flight home. So I had to sort of stretch the budget. I sort of, it was a case of sleeping at the side of the road most of the time, and it was a tough journey. But actually, I think that the biggest challenge really was going there. It was at a tricky time, and it's never a particularly easy time in places like Afghanistan. But Yeah, it was difficult. I mean, I had to sort of walk across half of Afghanistan, hitchhike through places like Iran, which at that time was tricky as well. But no, it was a really incredible journey. Yeah.
It wasn't always easy hitchhiking. I mean, in Russia, there didn't seem to be many people who wanted to stop and pick you up, were there?
Russia was probably the hardest bit, actually. It was. I got there just after, I don't know if people remember the Beslan massacre back in 2004, if you might have heard of that. Basically, a school was actually sadly, tragically attacked by some terrorists, and they killed a lot of teachers, a lot of children. And so the Russian security services basically went out rounding people up, anyone that looked vaguely sort of terrorist-like. And I made the mistake of turning up with a slightly overgrown beard, and you know.
Well,
young...
when you say slightly overgrown, there are some pictures in there. You look fully fledged Mujahideen at times, to be honest, don't you?
Well, I did pass as one in Afghanistan, yeah. But in Russia, that's fairly counterproductive because I got arrested 9 times.
And on what premise?
Well, they thought I was a Chechen terrorist.
That. Okay, yeah. Right, okay. And the other thing that probably didn't help was that you carried a Quran with you. So I should imagine that didn't help so much in Russia, but perhaps later in Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, it did.
Well, I was interested. I was, you know, I'd just finished university. I was trying to understand more about the regions that I was passing through, and I thought by the time I got to, you know, Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, a Quran would probably come in quite useful. Less so in Russia, where, of course, that just reinforced their belief that I was a Chechen terrorist. But I did also carry a bottle of whiskey to counterbalance that, which got me out of jail on 8 of those occasions.
What sort of reading material do you normally carry on your journeys? Do you have enough weight in your rucksack for that?
Well, I used to. I did. I mean, this was before the days of, you know, e-books and audiobooks and things. Mm. So that's showing my age a bit there. But I carried the books that really inspired me, and you know, books like The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk. Arthur Connolly was an inspiration. For those that haven't heard of Arthur Connolly, he's the guy in the 1830s who coined the term The Great Game, and he was the first person really who did this journey. He travelled overland, pretty much the same route that I took, all the way from England to India. So, and his mission was to see if it was possible to travel over the mountains, you know, to warn against a Russian invasion of, at that time, British India. So he managed it, although sadly on a later expedition he managed to get decapitated in Central Asia, but didn't work out too well for him. But I mean, his story was one of epic endurance. You know, it took him a year to do. I mean, mine was fairly tame compared to his. But you know, I like to find my inspiration in the stories of people that have gone and done these journeys before.
You have a companion at the beginning, an old friend, John Winfield. Tell us about him.
John was just a mate of mine from uni. He'd always wanted to go to Russia. I'd always wanted to go to India. And so we sort of said we'd do both. And that's why I did this little detour. He was slightly more sensible than me at the time and decided that when we got arrested for the 9th time, he wanted to go home, which he did. So he got a train back, and I carried on over the Caucasus to into Georgia and beyond.
But I get the impression, actually, that things picked up once you started to travel on your own. Was that because you had a different attitude or because people's reaction was different to you as a single person rather than as a pair?
I think it's just a different dynamic. I mean, John and I are still really good mates, actually, and we still chuckle over those times occasionally. But, when you travel on your own, and I guess for those people that have travelled on their own, it's just a very different dynamic. You're forced to go out, and rather than just being in your pair or your group, you're forced to go out and interact with people along the way. You don't have a choice. You know, you don't have somebody who's going to look after your bag while you go to the loo, for instance. You've got to do everything yourself, or you know, rely on other people that you meet along the way. So it kind of forces you to be more sociable. It kind of forces you to interact with the local people, the communities that you meet, and that taught me a lot. You know, it taught me to you've got to trust in people. You've got to trust in the kindness of strangers that you meet along the way. And whilst that can seem a little bit scary at times, actually, it also does give you that faith in humanity as well, especially in places where you wouldn't expect it, you know. And the journey that this book describes, you know, going through places with slightly negative connotations or bad reputations, actually I found that they were the best bits.
So somebody that was lovely to you was in Georgia, Lasher.
Lasher,
tell us
yes.
About him and his family.
So I, after I managed to get out of Russia and found myself in Georgia, a local guy called Lasher, he took me in. Georgia's, for those that haven't been, it's an amazing place, very friendly people. Took me in. I mean, he lived in a sort of 27th floor of this very old, crumbling Soviet apartment block. There was no running water, there was no electricity, so, you know, it was dinner by candlelight. And if you wanted water, you had to go down. The lift obviously didn't work. You had to walk all the way down to the bottom floor to go to the well. So it was very different days. Things have improved there now. But he had, you know, very, very poor, but looked after me. And I spent a few days with him. And he insisted, even though he had nothing, he insisted on giving me his week's wages to send me on my way, which was quite remarkable. And, you know, we couldn't keep in touch because he didn't have any... You know, this was before the days of Facebook, and so we didn't actually stay in touch until last year when I, for the latest journey, wanted to go and retrace a part of this journey by going over the Caucasus from Russia to Iran, which was on TV, I think, this year or last year. And I thought, I need to reconnect with Lasher. So we managed, there was no way of tracking him down. I didn't have an address. I knew his name, but he wasn't on any social media. And luckily, one of the researchers, she managed to find him by, I think it was LinkedIn or something, which is quite amazing. I met up with him, and after a very long time, it was great to catch up. And he was with me through the whole part of Georgia.
Fantastic. What did he and his family think about your journey? You say that you felt slightly uncomfortable that you were in this privileged position to be able to make this journey when they were in a poor position and there was a suggestion of refugees and so on.
Well, he was himself a refugee from Abkhazia, so he, you know...
He'd had to travel,
and he'd been forced to go, and he'd gone to Russia to try and work, to earn some money for his family. To be honest, they didn't really... I kind of describe a little bit about the challenge there of explaining what you're doing. If you tell people you're hitchhiking to India, they just sort of look at you blankly and wonder what on earth is wrong with you, usually. But if you tell them you're going to the next... And I found this on all my journeys. If you tell them that you're going to the next town, they find that far
they
more...
Get that.
They get that. And then, of course, they tell you it's far too dangerous because, you know, the next town's full of bad people, is usually the reaction. If you tell them that you're going to the next country, that they find that completely incomprehensible because they just think, why would anyone want to go to Turkey? Mm. So it's a balancing act. And the only way to do it is to... I mean, at this stage, I was a 22-year-old backpacker with no fixed abode, no income, and no real motivation other than wanting to go on a big adventure. But you kind of have to temper that by explaining that I had to sort of say, you know, I'm writing a book about this. I mean, that was beyond my wildest imagination that it would ever actually get published at that age. But I said that's what I was doing, and then it suddenly became real. He said, so you'll make some good money out of that then. Mm. I said, well, maybe one day, but probably not just yet.
So as well as the whiskey that you had in your backpack, there's quite a lot of talk about vodka in Russia.
I mean, vodka
was,
is the staple diet of at least half of this journey. Everywhere you go, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner is usually accompanied with 6 or 7 vodkas.
And there was a little bit of a scrape with a chap called Gotcha.
Gotcha, yes. So I was in the middle of Georgia. I'd said goodbye to Lasher. He'd sort of... shaking his head, telling me I was definitely going to be, you know, at least kidnapped, if not worse. But I carried on, and I was hitchhiking. It was getting quite late. I jumped out of a car, and I was in this tiny little village called Kutvisi, which is in central Georgia, well, right on the southern part of it. And it was too late to find anywhere to stay. It was on the outskirts of a village, so I sort of got my sleeping bag out and put it on sort of a... It was a bus stop at the side of the road. And I was just falling asleep, and then I heard 3 men, some voices coming out of the darkness, and I started getting worried because all of the warnings that Lasher told me about the fact that the next village, you know, is, you know, filled with terrorists and this, that, and the other, I was a bit nervous, and these guys were clearly very drunk. So I kind of woke up and they'd obviously heard me, and they came over and surrounded me and started shouting at me in Georgian, of which I didn't speak a word. And I was trying to communicate. I couldn't speak any Russian either. Eventually, we settled on GCSE level German. this guy, who was enormous, he was one of the biggest human beings I'd ever seen, sort of shouted at me and said, "Follow me," in German. And so I didn't really have much choice. And he took me into his farm, and you know, he gave me a bedroom, at which point I was slightly worried. But no, he cracked open the vodka again, and we basically communicated through a combination of very basic German and drawing pictures. It was sort of a game of charades. And he was, setting the world to rights. And, you know, it was great to actually try and communicate with somebody on a completely different level. And, I spent the night there. The next day I tried to leave, and he wouldn't let me. He said, "No, we're drinking vodka again." So he cracked up another bottle, and then we had to drink that all day. The next day, I tried to leave again. Out came another bottle of vodka. So it was a bit of a binge.
Bit of a trend developing here.
Yes. On the fourth day, I decided that enough was enough. When he'd gone to work, because he would sort of wake up at 5 o'clock to go and tend to the goats and the horses, I thought I hatched my plan. I wrote him a thank you note in
German.
In German. Dankeschön. And and then climbed out of the window. Because he had this enormous dog which was guarding the porch, so I couldn't go out of the front door. So I had to climb out of the window, shimmy down the drain pipe, jump onto the neighbour's roof and do a runner that way. That was 15 years ago. Last year when I went back, I thought, I've got to go and see if this guy's still there. So I found his village, and I kind of remembered vaguely where I was and which house it was, and just knocked on this door, which I think it was. I knew it was kind of one of three options. Knocked on this door, and there he was. Gotcha was stood there, and he sort of squinted at me, said, "Englishman." He closed the door without another word, came back with a bottle of vodka. He said, "It's time to drink."
Brilliant.
Yeah. So
has it been... I can imagine it must have been quite interesting going back and reading about yourself as a 22-year-old. Were there things that you thought, "Oh yeah, I was actually, you know, I'm quite proud of that," and other things that you thought, "Shall I keep that in the book or not?"
Well, it was a bit of a dilemma, because it was written, you know, I wrote this, I did the journey when I was 22. I kind of had a diary, and then I wrote it up effectively into, you know, I typed up my diary and kept it quite basic over the subsequent years. Whilst I was in the army, and then when I left the army, I kind of structured it into a few chapters and thought nothing more of it. I pitched it out to countless agents, countless publishers, and they all said no. And I thought, well, you know, it can stay on my laptop, that's fine. And when my publishers did say, you know, said, "Look, we should publish this," the question was, do I rewrite it completely from the perspective, you know, of myself now, having already written books and things, or do I just keep it as it was? And I made the conscious decision to keep it, for the most part, in its original form, because, you know, you change your mentality, and actually I wanted to keep it as a 22-year-old writing rather than me now. And so the writing style, I guess, is probably quite immature, but hopefully it gets across the mindset that a 22-year-old has. Mm.
There's quite a lot of travelling versus tourism. That's a fault line for you, isn't it? And well, you're sometimes quite annoyed that other Westerners might be here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at that time, you know, you're seeking something. You know, when you're in your early 20s, you're looking for something authentic. And I was out to prove to myself, and I suppose to other people, that I could do a journey like this. And so I was searching for that authenticity. And And I found it for the most part, but there were instances where you sort of go into these travellers' ghettos and you encounter people that never leave the hostel, and you kind of wonder what on earth they're doing there. But then, actually, you kind of grow up and think, well, if they just want to go on a holiday, and then there's nothing wrong with that. Mm. So, yeah.
But you can see in that the writer and the explorer and the TV person that you've become. It's all there, isn't it?
Well, like I say, I think that journey gave me the impetus to do other ones, and it gave me the confidence that I wasn't going to go and automatically drop dead the moment I enter a place that is on the news because it's had a war in the past few years, you know. And so I think that's what I learned. I thought, you know, I learned that you can go to places that, as long as you're careful, and I was careful to the point that I did a bit of background research and read up about the places and tried to learn a few words of the local language and just be respectful of the places that I'm going to. And I think that sets the tone.
Yeah. And we should say that Walking the Americas is new out in paperback. Who watched Walking the Americas? Yes. I think we all want to know, how's Alberto?
Alberto, he's good. He's good. He's coming over to the UK in a couple of weeks, actually. Yeah, he's doing very well. He only has to work 3 weeks of the year. He's doing rather well. He's a fashion photographer, and he's currently on a beach surrounded by sort of bikini-clad Brazilian supermodels.
Tough life.
Which is tough, isn't it? So he's basically decided that in between trips he just wants to go and travel. So good on him.
When you think about the different journeys that you've done, and we've said, you know, hugely privileged to do that, which is the one that you go to sleep thinking about? Americas, Nile, or Himalayas, or any others that you might have undertaken?
Well, I need to update that video because I've done two trips since then, and it's still I need to add a few more million steps on there. But the I've just got back from a trip. I got back 10 days ago from the latest. I was away in the Middle East for 5 months, so that's probably been the one that's been on my mind the whole time.
So tell us about that trip.
That actually was the one trip that I've been wanting to do over and above all the others. I think it's going to be hopefully the best one yet in terms of some of the stories and the characters that I met along the way. I first travelled in the Middle East in 2003 when I was a student and went to Iraq and a few other places.
When you say you travelled there, you hitchhiked back through Iraq, didn't you?
Yes, I hitchhiked home from Egypt.
Yes.
I missed the plane. So it was a trip I really wanted to go and revisit. And I've just done a circumnavigation of the whole Arabian Peninsula from Syria to Iraq, the Gulf, Yemen, all of it.
They're all hardcore, but that is hardcore to the power of N.
Well, I wanted to go and try and challenge some preconceptions and show people that there is more to the region than war, violence, and terrorism. And there is. Obviously, there is a lot of that going on, and I wanted to show both sides. So I did visit the conflict areas, but I also found some amazing stories of humanity amid the chaos, and hopefully that will come across. So that's the book that's coming next.
And are you able to share any particular stories about people that you met along the way?
I met some absolutely intriguing characters. We met everyone from the some slightly dodgy characters in Iraq, who were probably the bad guys until quite recently. I met Mossad agents, I met ISIS terrorists, I met both sides of every conflict that's going on in the region, if that makes sense. So I think it will be fascinating to see how that plays out. It's obviously a very controversial region, and everyone's got their own ideas on, you know, who's in the right and who's in the wrong. I tried to go there and be objective and non-judgmental and just try and get the stories from both sides. So watch this space.
I think the thing about the Middle East is that people often think of it as an homogenous region, but actually there are so many differences, aren't there, between the countries?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the differences in... there's a very tribal mentality in a lot of the places that I visited. There's a lot of division based on religious and ethnic lines. But also, there's the vast majority of people that I met, you know, they're not interested in war and violence. I mean, I went to a lovely wine bar in Damascus, and they did great sushi. You know, and there's a disco next door, and you don't expect that. But people are sitting there talking about what they've just seen on Netflix. The Syrians, I mean, whilst you can hear the artillery going off in the background, and I sort of found that quite surreal. But of course, you know, I was explaining that this has been going on for almost 7 years now. They're used to it, and they don't bat an eyelid. And the fact that mortars were landing, you know, a mile away, and they were just sort of getting on with their lives.
It's normalised. Yeah. One of the things that comes through in all your writing is about hospitality and how, you know, people do welcome you in and welcome the cameras in and so on. But you have yourself a three-day hospitality rule, don't you? Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, the hospitality has been, I guess, the enduring feature of all of these journeys, in the sense that by putting yourself out there, by being respectful, hopefully people will look after you. And for the most part, that's been the case. People do take you into their homes. They invite you to share their lives for a small amount of time. And often that's the poorest members of community are some of the most welcoming and generous. And I actually took this from, I think it was my first backpacking trip when I was 18. I went around, traveled around India. And I stayed at the Golden Temple in Amritsar, in the holiest Sikh shrine. And there's a rule there. You can stay for free for 3 days and three nights. And I thought that's quite a nice... It's a nice rule, because beyond that, you don't want to sort of intrude or sort of go a step over the mark. And so I've taken that with me. And whenever I stay with, you know, local families, I've always... And people will say, look, stay for a week. You know, I'll build you a house. And I've had all sorts of weird and wonderful offers, but I think I always try and keep it to 3 days maximum, because you don't want to overstay your welcome.
And is that the same in your? Have you got a sign up in your own house? 3 day rule.
I mean, that's itchy feet after 3 days, but no, hopefully, I'm back now.
No,
for
I don't
a while.
Mean you. I mean your guests.
Oh, my guests. Yeah,
what sort of host are you?
I throw them out after 3 days.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. So this book was up for an award, was shortlisted for an award at the Edward Stanford's awards dinner the other evening, and unfortunately you weren't able to be there, but you had a very good reason. Tell us about that.
I'm afraid I couldn't make the awards. I was very, very kindly invited to become an ambassador for a charity called the Endeavour Fund, which is Prince Harry's veterans charity, and I had to go and compare the evening, so I was doing your job... MCing for those
guys. But at the palace?
It was actually at Goldsmiths Hall, which but it was still quite nice.
So tell us about that charity.
Well, as a soldier myself, I'm very interested in veterans issues, and I think it's nice to pay back, and if there's a way of encouraging ex-servicemen and veterans to take up new sports or adventurous challenges as a way of rehabilitation after injury, then why not? I think it's doing a really good job.
Fantastic. Good. Right, well, let's open up the floor to questions, because I'm sure there are lots. Have we got microphones handy? Pop your hand up if you've got a question for Leveson. There's one over here. He can run that, Roddy.
Hi, it's not a question, but it was just a thank you. I went to one of your talks last year in the summer, and I just quit my job and I was going travelling. And you mentioned to me, you know, don't plan your trip, just go off and see what happens.
And did that work?
It did. I had a fabulous time.
Where did you go?
Thank you. Nepal, Bhutan, Australia, Philippines, and Sri Lanka.
Nice. Very good.
Do you find that? I mean, do you enjoy being an inspiration for people?
No, it's great, isn't it? You know, I think if I'd say to anyone, just if you've got a burning desire to go to one particular place or just go away and go to a new place, then go for it. You know, it can only lead to good things, I would like to think.
Great, well done. Okay, question over here, and then we'll come to you afterwards, the lady with the blonde hair there. Yes.
So whenever I travel, I worry that I'm going to lose my passport or come across a situation where I have to give it in or not know where I get it back. Have you ever had a situation where you have given in your passport and worried about kind of getting out of that situation, passport in hand?
There's a lot of hotels, particularly in the Middle East where I've just been, where you have to, every hotel you have to check in and leave your passport overnight. So it's, I guess you just get used to it and just let go, whatever happens, you know. I once left my passport on a bus and it had driven 150 miles before I'd realised, and I had to then, you know, ring up the bus company, and the bus driver very kindly drove 150 miles back to give it to me. So that was good of him.
Okay, question here. Who's got the microphone here? Yes.
Hi, I'm reading Eastern Horizon at the moment, and the question that came to my mind is that did you ever get to meet the army officer who found your wallet?
No, I haven't. I have not managed to track him down. Second Lieutenant James Whitehurst, everyone knows him. I've tried a few times, but he's disappeared off the radar. I don't know what ever happened to him. One day I will.
Okay, we'll come to you next. Yep.
What has been your hardest walk?
My hardest trip? Probably the Nile, probably walking the Nile, just because when I did that, I had no idea how long it was going to take. I had no idea how many miles a day I could walk and push myself for. And beyond that, I had no idea whether or not, you know, it was going to be too dangerous. You know, there are lots of dangers along the way. So that was probably the hardest one. And also, when you're away from... I mean, that took 9 months of walking. So, you know, it can be quite hard to motivate yourself every day to keep walking. So that was very hard. But since then, you kind of, I've got into a bit of a routine now. So, yeah.
Okay, question over here.
Hi. I'm interested in how you sort of structure the team for your trips, because I follow you on Instagram, and it's great. How do you sort of select your team, and how do you keep everyone sort of motivated and you know, interested and to keep going on your journeys?
On my jollies. So basically, the team that I've worked with over the past 5 years now, originally it was sort of, we started off with a production company that sort of gave me a couple of guys. And I mean, you've obviously got to get on with the people, right? So if you know, there was a couple that I didn't get on with so well, and they got the boot. But actually, we've kind of refined it now. So there's like four or five key members that come in and out. Ash here sort of has been on all the trips at some stage for a week or two at a time. Got Neil, my director. There's a guy called Dave and another guy called Simon who's, you know, who sort of helped with the logistics and the security. So there's like four or five guys who come out, you know, they sometimes with me, sometimes not, sometimes with me, you know, physically they're walking, sometimes they're in it, you know, setting things up ahead. But for the last trip around the Middle East, that wasn't actually a commission from any of the TV channels. So I set up the team and we took a punt and just did it ourselves. And sometimes you just got to do that.
And what's the atmosphere on that team? Is it all quite sort of macho and roughy-toughy get out there? Or actually is there a calm person who says, OK, no, let's just think how this is going to go?
Yeah, we're all very different personalities. I think that's good. It's not just guys. There's Charlotte, who's on the team as well. So, you know, everyone brings something to it. And everyone's got their own unique skills. And I think that's good. It's good to sort of have that diversity and good to... everyone's motivated because we're all sort of, we all want it to work, and if it doesn't, I'm gonna have to go and get a job.
God forbid. Other question just here, pop then, we'll come to you in a second. Yes,
hi Levison. Mine's quite a simple question, really. Are all of the trips that you go on sort of, how do you find your inspiration? Is most of it from the TV companies, which you touched on the question before, or is it somewhere you've always inspired to go to? So how do you find where your next trip is?
Okay, so the question there, if you didn't hear, was where do I get the sort of inspiration, and why those journeys in particular? Yeah. So actually, they've all been my ideas that I've taken, or they've asked me, you know, where do you want to go next? And I've basically said where I want to go next, really. So in terms of the inspiration, it's tended to be, I mean, I studied history at university, and that's been my passion throughout. So it's generally been places where I've either been interested in the history of that particular region, or where there's been previous explorers that have done a similar journey. And, that, you know, we do have a great... there's a legacy of exploration in this country, and I think it's, for me, fascinating to read accounts of people that did journeys 150 years ago and see how things perhaps have changed, how they haven't changed. And so I take my inspiration from other explorers, most of whom are long dead, or just places that I think, you know, they're in the news. They tend to be in the news for the wrong reasons, places like the Middle East or the Caucasus, Chechnya, and actually, why not go and see what the reality is like and hopefully challenge the sort of that narrative and show people the ground truth, I suppose. And you know, it can shine a spotlight on a region that probably doesn't get the best press, and why not? You know, I think it can only hopefully help.
Question here, yeah.
Thank you for coming today, sir.
Thank you. Where am I looking?
Just over here, sir.
Yeah.
Now, I'm planning an expedition on foot across Iran.
Okay.
And I was wondering, what are the particular challenges that you've found, the biggest challenges, and what are your favorite parts of the country?
Iran. The biggest challenge probably is just getting the visa. Especially if you're British, then that's that at the moment is tricky. I mean, we had a minder, but that was just because we were filming there. When you're in, you'll be absolutely fine because it's an incredibly friendly country. The people there are amazing. And I don't think you'll have any problems, really. I mean, I think it's certainly one of the most welcoming and hospitable countries I've been to. It's very well developed for the most part, especially in the cities. And, everything you need is there. I mean, Tehran is there's a great sort of hipster vibe going on because coffee shops. It's nice, yeah. Sorry? Any particular advice on getting the visa? Get a non-British passport. Or I'm sure if you go and present yourself at the embassy and be nice to them, they'll explain what you're doing. They're reasonable people.
There's lots about Iran in here, and also in the bookshop, Revolutionary Ride by Lois Price, yes, as well. Yes, question right at the back there.
You've seen so much of the world, and you always stay for only 3 days in one place, but have you never been somewhere where you've been sort of so mind-blown by, like, this perfection that you've been tempted to stay, to settle somewhere else?
Well, the rule's 3 days in one bed, not necessarily one place. Slight difference, but... there's been lots of places I've wanted to return to, and actually a lot of, you know, these journeys are places that I have travelled to when I was younger and have wanted to return to see how, you know, how things may have changed. There's certain places that I love going back to, like Nepal. South Africa is a place I'm very keen to go back to. Especially on, you know, the Russia to Iran journey that I did last year was effectively revisiting some of the places in Eastern Horizons. For sure. I mean, that's the challenge we face, isn't it? You know, we're sort of in a lucky position where we're fortunate we can travel fairly easily, I suppose, these days. It's just choosing where's next, isn't it? And this is why shows like this exist.
Anywhere taking your fancy?
I think they're trying to get me to go to the Azores, which would be nice.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah, or the Faroe Islands.
A question just down in the front here.
It was quite similar to what you actually just said, but what's next on, like, your bucket list, what destination you haven't been to or an experience you haven't had that you really want to?
What's next? I only got back 10 days ago, so I'm going to put my feet up for a little while. I don't know. I've not planned anything yet. For the first time in 5 years, I've not actually lined up my next trip, so I'm going to have a think.
Other questions? There's one here, and then we'll come to you. Oh, no, we're going to you. Who's got the mic? And then we'll come to you.
Sorry, I can't...
You've been travelling by yourself a lot,
yep.
And you've been travelling with a camera crew.
Yeah.
How does that compare? Is that a help or a hindrance for your exploration and what you want to achieve?
Is the camera crew a help or a hindrance? Well, I mean, basically all the crew are basically some of our, you know, best mates, really, so it's certainly not a hindrance. The process of documenting a journey can sometimes be time-consuming, it can be a pain, it can be... it can sometimes detract from the enjoying being in the moment, of course, but ultimately, you know, I'm very privileged to be doing what I'm doing as a job, and it is effectively a job, and there is a duty to come home with content, with footage, photos. So it's finding that balance. You know, I try and enjoy myself. You know, it's great. It's a great privilege, and it is what it is. I try and also balance that by occasionally going on holiday where I don't take my camera, for instance. So that's what I'm doing next.
Question here.
Is your Middle East trip being televised? And if so, when are we likely to see it?
Well, I hope so. I filmed it, but because because it wasn't a commission, I'm free to sell it to whoever wants to buy it. So anyone here work for Netflix? Or...
Who'd like to see that series?
Okay, right, if you can all write a nice letter to Netflix, that'd be lovely. Or Channel 4, whoever.
Yes, you've been waiting patiently.
Thanks for coming, and thanks for being an inspiration to my family, particularly my two daughters, who are doing a bit of the Essex Way, and they're calling it their Levinson Walk. But the question I want to ask is, you go to places that the Foreign Office say we shouldn't go to.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, are the government overcautious, or are you super fearless?
I wouldn't want to comment on what the Foreign Office advice is, nor would I ever want to necessarily counter it. I mean, I have to work closely with the Foreign Office. I let them know where I'm going. They always say, officially, we definitely cannot rescue you if anything goes wrong there. But I've got, you know, I've got a decent relationship with them. I'm still technically in the army, so I can sort of hopefully pull a few strings if it did go Pete Tong. But no, I mean, ultimately, you know, you've got to, it's there because they have to err on the side of caution. But obviously, that has an impact on your travel insurance and things like that, which can be a pain from you. But yeah, I mean, they're doing a job, right? And they their job is to keep British people safe, and if that means they, I mean, if I sometimes do find it frustrating in somewhere like Afghanistan, for instance, which there's a blanket sort of warning on, where actually you go to somewhere like the Wakhan Corridor in the northeast, which is completely safe, completely. They've not had any incidents there at all, and you can travel there quite freely and have a great time. Likewise, parts of Iran. So, yeah, there's no easy answer there. I don't work for the Foreign Office, so I can't really say.
Thank you. Okay, other questions? There's a question down here, if we could get a mic there, and then we'll come to you afterwards.
You go on these lovely places, but you say it's like for work and with the camera crew. Where would you go to relax and have a holiday yourself?
Where would I go to relax and have a holiday? I've never been to Portugal. I'd love to go to Portugal and drink some port. Sit on a beach in Ibiza. Yeah, I'm totally happy to go and do that as well. Yeah.
Okay, good. Question here.
Hi, Leveson. It's two things, I suppose. Now that you're a well-heeled and successful author and a well-known personality, are you prepared to honour your debt to Alton Towers?
Are
you prepared to honour your debt to Alton Towers?
I will go and buy a ticket, yes. I will definitely go and buy a ticket this time.
Second thing, can you update us on Boston and how Boston's getting on?
Yes. So those that didn't watch the Nile, Boston was my guide for the first half of Walking the Nile. He's good. We're in constant WhatsApp comms, usually him asking me for money. no, he's fine. He's coming over to the UK in May, I think. He's trying to get his own TV series away, I think, doing something. So watch this space on that one. Yeah.
Okay. Questions over here, Jude. We'll come to you and then to you afterwards. Yeah.
Hi there. Hello. Had a really bad accident. I just wanted to know how that affected you. Did it have any impact mentally?
My accident, so, back in 2016, I was in a taxi and the brakes failed and it went flying off a cliff and I managed to mangle my arm and break my shoulder and things. Has it affected me mentally? I hope not. I don't know.
It made you more cautious? I'm thinking not.
I mean, I've always been terrified of those roads that you get in Nepal, and but that's actually the third time that happened, so I've kind of got used to it now. But yeah, no, roads, going down hills in dodgy cars, I don't like. But I've luckily been, you know, still here in one piece, and I've not had any sort of negative reaction, I suppose.
Okay, there's a question. Somebody had their hand up over. Okay, if you've got the mic, you go first, and then pop your hand back up, whoever was over here, and we'll get a mic to you next.
Have you ever feared for your life?
Sorry, where am I looking? Hello, madam. Have I ever feared for my life? Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, probably the 10 seconds before the car went flying off the edge of the cliff was rather terrifying. Apart from that, quite a few times on most of these journeys, actually. There's always been a few moments where you do wonder, is it a great idea? On the last journey, I won't spoil it by going into too much detail, but I was in Yemen, and Yemen's certainly a place that the Foreign Office advises not to go to. I was in Yemen sort of under the auspices of one of the local tribes, and we had to leave, and for various reasons, which I won't go into right now, but we ended up on a dhow, one of these wooden ships that usually trade in all sorts of illicit goods across the Arabian Sea. And we'd agreed to take us around the coast of Yemen, which the Gulf of Aden is fairly heavily trafficked by Somali pirates. So we spent 5 days on a wooden dhow, which was filled to the rafters with cockroaches and rats. And instead of taking us to Djibouti, it actually dropped us off in Somalia, on the coast there. And it, obviously, because it couldn't go into the port, so it stopped off about 3 miles off the coast. And a small skiff came to pick me up off this boat to take me to the port. And having watched one too many films about pirates, there was a moment there where I thought, is this a great idea? I've been fairly lucky, I suppose.
Mm. We've got time for one more final question. Who's got the mic there? Yes. Make it a good one.
That's a lot of pressure. I was wondering, with your recent first-hand experience in the Middle East, how hopeful you are for the region, specifically in terms of kind of Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question. I went to the Middle East with, having read as much as I could about the various regions. I mean, I went through 13 countries. 13 countries on this last trip, so it's obviously very complicated. I came away even more bewildered than I went in, frankly. It's very complicated. There's lots of people with agendas, and sadly, there's a lot of people for whom it's in their interest to keep these conflicts going. And I think that is apparent, in what we see in the conflicts that's happening. So, am I hopeful? I'd like to think so. I met enough people that want peace to make it hopeful. Sadly, they were 99% of the average people on the street want peace. There's just a few people in power, sadly, in various regions that kind of it's in their interests not to. So, yeah, complicated.
Well, let's leave it on a note of hope. Thank you.
On a note of hope.
Leveson,
yes.
Will be
you.
Over in the Stanford stand signing these books and others that are there. So do please go and join him there. Go out, have fun, stay safe, and come back and tell us all about
thank
it next
you.
Time.
Thank you very
thank
much
you,
for coming.
Leveson Wood.
Thank you.